I always kept a journal because that's where I could speak. If I couldn't speak outwardly, I could speak inwardly on the page. I had a locked journal from my brothers and parents.
So eventually you wrote a children's book, co-authored.
Yeah, that seemed safe. But would you believe me if I told you, the first book that I wrote was with Ted Major, who was at the Teton Science School my mentor. It was published here in San Francisco on Bush Street from Sierra Club Books. When I found out that that was being published and Diana Landau was my editor, I did not tell anyone except for my husband for a year.
That it had been published?
That it was accepted.
Really?
And I'm still shocked by that, but I think it was a transgressive act to have a voice.
As a woman in the Mormon church?
Yes, even if it was about snow.
That meant that it must have taken a lot of effort and guts to put out Refuge, to write it and then get it published.
It still does.
Really?
I mean, I've been nervous for this interview, you know, this conversation, because I think every time I open my voice, I know that I am transgressing against my heritage. And, you know, I'm 64 years old. Every time I go to speak publicly, I am terrified. And then I forget about it, and it's not about me. It's about something so much larger than ourselves. But there are consequences. And I'm aware of that. I'm also aware of the privilege of a voice and why it matters to speak, especially now. So many people are afraid, rightfully so. And I just feel, you know, if I can't speak, if I can't find the courage to say the unsayable, then I have no business being a writer.
Terry Tempest Williams, you've completed this book. Do you have another book on the horizon?
I don't. I just want to be in the desert watching birds and putting out water during drought.
You've been listening to an interview with Terry Tempest Williams, whose latest book is Erosion, Essays of Undoing. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves. An extended version of this interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. Book Waves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Today's archive edition of Black Book Talk features a 2008 interview with James McBride and discusses his books Song Yet Sung and Miracle at St. Anna, which was then in the process of being turned into a movie by director Spike Lee. His book The Good Lord Bird was the 2013 winner of the National Book Award for Fiction and is currently a Showtime limited series starring Ethan Hawke. And now, Black Book Talk.
Gray morning in March 1850, a colored slave named Liz Spocott dreamed of the future, and it was not pleasant. She dreamed of Negroes driving horseless carriages on shiny rubber wheels with music booming throughout, and fat black children who smoked odd-smelling cigars and walked around with pistols in their pockets and murder in their eyes. She dreamed of Negro women appearing as flickering images in powerfully lighted boxes that could be seen in sitting rooms far distant, and colored men dressed in garish costumes like children, playing odd sporting games and bragging like drunkards, every bit of pride, decency, and morality squeezed clean out of them. Liz had this dream in captivity, just as the flickering light of her own life was disappearing, and when she awoke from it, realized with a gasp that it was some kind of apparition, that she had to find its true meaning in this world before she died. This brought her more grief than her condition at the time, which was not pleasant, in that she'd been lying for 3 weeks, badly wounded, imprisoned in an attic on Maryland's eastern shore.
Good morning and welcome to Black Book Talk. This is Patricia Welch, Library Lady.
And I'm Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
And you just heard the voice of our guest for the day, Mr. James McBride, who is reading from his latest book, Song Yet Sung. Welcome to Black Book Talk.
I feel black already.
Well, he's also the author of another wonderful book called...
The Color of Water.
Mr. McBride, tell us about your character. That was kind of a somber beginning to the book, but tell us what was happening and what was happening to you.
To the character in Song Yet Sung?
Yeah.
She is a slave who's living in 1850 in Maryland, on the eastern shore of Maryland, and she can dream the future. She dreams only in bits and pieces, and she dreams a future that seems bleak, in which kids run from books like they're poison, and black folks call each other the N-word, and young men treat young women with absolute disrespect. She dreams of some of the more negative aspects of hip-hop culture. And I say just the negative aspects of hip-hop culture, because as you certainly know, I'm sure you agree, that hip-hop is a great art form. Just so happens that some of it is extraordinarily toxic.
Is this based on something you read, this character, somebody's great-grandmother's story, or?
No, I mean, not really. I mean, when I was growing up, they used to say I had the thrash, because my father died before I was born. I could, you know, I suppose he could heal babies. You know, my family's from North Carolina.
Their mouth.
Right, yeah.
Yes.
You know, all that Southern stuff. So, you know, when a person could tell the future, they would call him two-headed. That's that down south stuff. You know, my family's from New York, but, you know, as you know, every black person who's from New York is really from somewhere else. So I used to hear this kind of talk when I was young, and I kind of harvested it when I created this character.
Was this woman someone who had this ability from birth?
No, this woman was struck on the head as a child, and for that reason would drop asleep and wake up and having dreamed of something. And that's really pulled from Harriet Tubman's life. Because Harriet Tubman, when she was a child, was struck on the head with an anvil, and she would always fall asleep in the middle of the day, and then she would wake up, and she would later in life propose that when she was sleeping, she would have dreams that foretold what was coming, if she, you know, if she needed to hold, if she was running some people up and down the gospel train, if it was, you know, should they move, should they not, so forth. So
this character was inspired by Harriet
Tubman. You can say she was inspired by Harriet Tubman, but she doesn't have anything else in common with Harriet Tubman other than that.
You know, most folks out here have not yet had a chance to see the book. It's just been recently published, so.
Well, I mean, you know, it's basically just a chase story. I mean, it deals with some of the deep elements of slavery, the web of relationships that existed during slavery. But it's basically about a young black woman, a black-looking black woman, who leads a breakout from a slave stealer's house. There are three types of people who worked in what was known as the trade. You had the slave catchers, you had the slave traders, and then you had the most notorious and ruthless of them all, were people who were slave stealers who would steal slaves down on the eastern shore and then sell them to traders who floated up from New Orleans on boats. They would sell them to these New Orleans slave traders, and then they would never be seen again. So the hero of this book has led the escape, a breakout of 14 slaves from a slave stealer's house. And the rest of the book really is just a chase between this young lady who's running for what was once what she considered to be freedom, though she has these dreams and she's not sure that freedom is in the North. It's between her and a slave stealer named Patty Cannon, who's based on a real character, who's trying to catch her. And a third character named the Gimp, who's a slave catcher who's been hired to catch her. So she has two different entities trying to catch her. She's assisted by some who work on the gospel train, and she's not assisted by others who are black who don't work on the gospel train, who are afraid to be involved in that sort of aiding and abetting a runaway. History in America is told as mythology. That's what happens. So that pictures of Harriet Tubman, you know, when you see pictures of her, you know, she looks like an old woman ready to cook flapjacks, when Jesse James looks like the hero who's going to ride herd and save the world, even though, you know, he was a slave owner. In fact, he shot and killed an 11-year-old kid for nothing. You know, just happened to be standing in the street when he was committing one of his robberies. What I'm trying to do is just toss the real history of slavery into the mythology of the American myth-making machine, and then bring it into the kind of discourse that would help us talk about it in ways that are healthier than the ways we talk about it now.
Were you doing the same with Soldiers, with your second book?
Yeah, that's what I did with Miracle of St. Anna, yeah. Miracle of St. Anna is about a black soldier who befriends a little Italian kid in Italy during World War II, and it's based on the 92nd Division. Spike Lee made that into a movie, which is coming out this November. I wrote the screenplay for that.
Well, you're a legend in my family because I particularly like the whole dynamics between your mother and the stepfather who lived at his own place and how he used to take you all on vacations in the summer and the thing that happened to your friend that one summer. I have told that to my two sons probably 1,000 times about anything could happen to you. You're not indestructible.
Oh, you mean Chicken Man? Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's part of the fragility of black life is quite real. Most white people think you make it up. I tell that to my children all the time, you know. Nobody's going to understand your situation, and you're not there to explain it to them. You just have to do good in school, trust in God, and keep rolling. Black children don't have a lot of room to make mistakes. Any child who comes from a working-class family in this country, white or black, doesn't have a lot of room to make mistakes, but particularly minority children. I've visited prisons and seen young people. I can tell you that, you know, there's some really smart people in prison. The most insightful questions, the most intelligent, thoughtful responses to my work come from young men who are in prison. It's deadly to see it. But in any case, going back to the book at hand, buy the book. That's it. Take my word for it. Go and buy it, you know?
No. Our listeners require more. You can't just tell our listeners to buy the book. They want to know more. They would probably want to know about Denwood Long, White Slave Catcher, why he is as he is. Can you tell us a little bit about this character?
Liz Spokot is the main character of the book, and she's the one who's running away. And Denwood Long is hired by her master to catch her. Denwood Long is a waterman. You know, on the Eastern Shore, the watermen were fishermen who fished for oysters. And they would drop these 26-foot, 28-foot long tongs down to the floor of the Chesapeake, pull them up, just yank them up and pull up oysters. They would find what was called a sandbar, and they would just tong for oysters. And it was very, very demanding. It was really hard work. So Denwood Long is an oysterman. He also happens to be a slave catcher because most watermen had to do something else during the year. They couldn't just make it catching oysters.
So this was his part-time job.
Okay. Well, you know, some people are dog catchers, some slave catchers. What are you going to say? You have to divorce yourself from brutality of that particular period if you're going to write about it. Otherwise, you can't write about it effectively. So he gets offered a lot of money by this owner to catch this one slave. And he takes it as his one last job. And he has a lot of ambiguity about slavery and slave owners. He doesn't like slave owners. He doesn't like slaves either. He's a troubled person. Most people like that are troubled one way or the other. People who have misgivings and prejudices are usually troubled about something. There's nothing to do with the misgivings and prejudices that they have, at least in my books. So even though Denwood Long is a, you know, bad person, he's nowhere near as evil as, say, Patty Cannon.
I kind of like that you had evil woman here, because I don't recall ever reading or seeing play, film, movie about a woman who was a slave catcher. I mean, before reading this book, it just never even occurred to me that there would be a woman operating in this way, in this field. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm not saying this is a role model we want to adopt, but then again, you want to see that the role of women is beyond what we're thinking and also what women were doing.
Well, Patty Cannon was real. She was a real person who had a real house on the Eastern Shore. Her house was located right on the Maryland-Delaware line. It was in three different counties so that when they came to arrest her, she could just step into one room and be in a different jurisdiction. I kind of like that idea, actually. So she was actually a real person, and she was a real slave stealer. Said to be a very beautiful woman, big woman, very ruthless. Would kill other slave traders if necessary. You can't make that kind of character up. I suppose you could, but I couldn't. Patty Cannon is actually her real name, and there was a real Patty Cannon.
Why did you want to write this story? I mean, you've written other things, a whole world of books you could have written.
I don't know. I was driving down on the Eastern Shore one day, and I saw a sign that said Harriet Tubman was born near here, and I just started driving around. The Eastern Shore is really quite a unique place. I mean, it's a place where there was a lot of very enormously talented black people came from the Eastern Shore of Maryland. James Baldwin's family was from the Eastern Shore. Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, they both were born within 25 miles of each other during the same era in the Eastern Shore. And apparently the Eastern Shore, because it has so many waterways, people are finally starting to figure out the way that Harriet Tubman moved so many of these African Americans from the South to the North was on the water, using watermen, black watermen, who knew how to ford the swamps and creeks. The Eastern Shore is all water. It's all rivers and swamps. It's creepy at night. Even when you see the depictions of slaves running for freedom, you often see them in these swampy areas with, you know, snakes around and so forth. You're looking at what the Eastern Shore looks like at night. It just seemed a great area to write fiction. And when we write about slavery, why does it have to always be bestiality and, you know, and somebody getting whipped by the master and so forth? Why not show them the story of what went on rather than giving them the Aesop's fable of Harriet Tubman? You know, every time they present Harriet Tubman, it's kind of like a little kiddie story. She did this good thing. Kumbaya, my lord. You know, then they show Jesse James or Kit Carson or something. You know, Wild Bill Hickok. Yeah. Black history is like dull as dishwater. If you were running slaves on the gospel train, you really had to know what you were doing.
Talk a little bit about the code.
Well, the code is the way that black folks would, they would communicate with each other. And they, a lot of it was unspoken business. Because you'd be in a room, you know, white folks were not stupid, particularly on the Eastern Shore. They knew it was only 80 miles from Philly. Blacks had to come up with methods and means to communicate whether or not you were one that could be trusted. So they had what was called the code. Some of it was in the music. You know, we would break bread together on our knees, wade in the water, of course. But there were others, like I'm a soldier in the army. There were other means of communicating, like if you saw someone, you scratched a crooked line in the dirt. That meant that you could be trusted because evil travels in straight lines. A lot of stuff. There were things that I talk about it in the book quite a bit. You know, chance is an instrument of God. There were expressions that you knew if someone else knew those expressions, that they were working the gospel train too. Like you could tie a rope in a certain kind of way, tie a knot on a boat, and you could tie it in five different knots. If you saw every one of those knots, you knew the guy who tying those knots was working the gospel train, and his master, the captain, could be standing right next to him, but nothing was said.
Your main character is given a series of codes, and at first she doesn't understand them. And so the codes could be unclear even to the person who has them.
The codes in the book is deeper than just words. The codes is how, from that moment to now, we still live. There's that unspoken business. If I was Clarence Thomas, would you be talking to me like this? First of all, if I was Clarence Thomas, I wouldn't be sitting in this room. But even if I was, you know, you would be polite. You say, well, Mr. Thomas, you know, very nice. And, but in your own head, you're saying, I'm burning up an hour. It's a waste of time. What you're saying, you say, I'm burning up an hour with a guy who has caused an enormous amount of destruction, and I'm wasting time. So what can I do that's positive? There would be no real communication there between you and Clarence Thomas. But now I'm sitting here. There's a lot of unspoken business that's going on right now, most of which is like, you know, a lot of young people listening to this show. You better get to your book. You better talk about your book. Don't come in here trying to just sell us some smoke and puff because we can have somebody else here. We don't feel well. I mean, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of unspoken business that goes on between black folks. Now it's much more subtle and it's not as universal, but it's still there. During slavery, my thesis is that the unspoken business amongst black people was much more life and death. And so if I was working the code and you were not, and I told you something about the code and you went and spilled the beans, I'm liable to turn around and just slice your throat because I know if you tell somebody, my wife and children are at risk. There's a whole chapter in the book where the gimp, you know, he goes to the blacksmith who's known as the blacksmith and he's working the code. He's working the code because he gives signals by the way he pounds his hammer. Black folks walking by and he's hammering his hammer one way. It means hold. If he's hammering another way, it means it's time to clear. If he's hammering another way, it means that we got somebody we're trying to move through town and so forth. And he tells the gimp straight up, you know, if I reveal the location of this young woman, Liz, my wife and children be dead before my feet hit the floor outside there. I mean, that's the kind of rage, for example, that black people feel when they think of someone like Clarence Thomas. But I'm not proposing to anyone to go and kill a Supreme Court judge. I'm not saying that. My point is that, I'm just making it clear, I'm not saying that. I'm just giving you an example that during that time, if someone was working the gospel train, if you were to betray the gospel train, those who worked on it, your suffering could potentially be very great.
No matter how you feel about it, a lot of people in our communities are operating in the same way because of what they have to do to live. Exactly. And if somebody else betrayed them, the consequences could be the same.
Yes, unfortunately, that is very true. Because, you know, if you have someone who gets shot in a drug bust or something like that and gets in a raid, or there's some problem that goes on, the young kid is young people, or not just young people, anyone is afraid to reveal to the police what they've really seen, because they know the police go home to the suburbs and they stay where they live. And when the police say, you know, why don't you people come forward to help your community, they don't realize that your community is always your community 24/7, 365. When the police go home, they play in softball on the weekend with Beth and little Shannon, and you know you're getting shot up because you blabbed on somebody. These are difficult issues, and these are issues that affect mostly poor Latino and black people. It affects some white folks, but it affects mostly poor Latino and black people. The book reflects that we are still enslaved now as we ever were.
What is freedom? I can remember when I was growing up, black people would say, you know, in some cases, especially older black people, they say integration may be the worst thing that ever happened to us.
I don't think about that because I have children myself, and I just want my children to live a good life. The whole business of what went on in our communities when we were young and what exists now is almost immaterial. I personally think that, you know, we just have to put our shoulder to the wheel and deal with what is now. The whole whether we're integrated or not. Integration is here. We're never going to be segregated like we were before. The whole business of free blacks and enslaved blacks is really has to do more with educated, integrated blacks and uneducated, segregated blacks now. Because that's really where African Americans live. You have, quote unquote, lesser educated African Americans, and then those of us who are more educated. And then those of us who are more educated have a responsibility, in my opinion, to reach back, each one teach one. It's just, that's it. So that's our moral and ethical responsibility. That's my own personal belief.
We have about 2 minutes left in this interview, and I've been asking.
We haven't talked about my book enough. I could have been selling my book. Can we back the tape? Excuse me, miss. Tell her to back that tape up and take Condi out and put
other comments in.
Yeah,
yes.
We don't care about her. I suppose the school teacher here among us could say, but I can say this, you know, when I go back to Red Hook, I respect everybody. Well, I say thank you. You know, once in a while I'll say, you know what? I say, young blood, why don't you come here? Get over here. I just show them love. That's all they want. I mean, it's not even about respect. It's just about love. I'm never afraid around young black men.
I totally agree with you that you can still do a lot and say a lot if you do it from a loving place.
Most of all, with small kids, I have learned that a lot goes with touch, although we aren't supposed to touch them anymore. But you can't tell a third grader if they're trying to hug you. You don't push them away and say, oh, no, teachers can't touch students.
Right, right.
They come and cry and put snot all over me, just boo. And I'm not going to tell them no. But I do see that sometimes they don't understand just simple signals or signs that adults would give. If my dad said, all right, you sweats, he used to call us sweats, you sweats it, because I want to talk to you. If we were going to visit relatives or something, he would say, no, you're not going to go over here talking about something you don't know nothing about. My dad was a union organizer. And that meant whatever we had overheard him saying to people trying to get them to join, we weren't to have conversations about that. So he didn't even have to go any further than just saying, don't talk about anything you don't know nothing about.
That plays right back into what we were talking about in terms of the code. The whole business of the code is it stays between us. There's a whole scene in the book where this young mother teaches her son the code, but she doesn't teach it to her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy says, why do I have to learn this junk? And she says, if you say that again, I forgot what she said, but she threatens to raise some whelps on his tail end because she's teaching him the code, but she doesn't tell her husband because her husband doesn't believe in being free. What your father really was teaching you was freedom. That's what he was really saying to you. He was saying there's a time to say stuff. See, as a best-selling author, I can sit here and yak about Condoleezza Rice to your community and say, well, if something happens to me, they'll say, well, you know, he was a best-selling author. Why'd the guy disappear? But, you know, some things need to be said sometimes, and some things need to be said other times. Sometimes you need to say stuff like this in our society. Other times, it need not be said. But since we were talking about the code, you know, which I talk about in my book.
We called you here to bring your message. So whatever
zippity
you called
about. Zippity
so whatever your message is.
Well, I better go sell his book.
Well, but we have a CD that has your name on it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So now you're a musician.
You're a musician.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about that. Why did you choose? You have a, what, master's and advanced degree or something in music, but you also had a degree in journalism. Right. Why did you choose that as opposed to continuing with music?
Oh, I got tired of playing those wedding gigs and stuff.
Okay.
You know, I got tired. It's hard. And getting on the road. I worked with Anita Baker for a while. I worked with Grover Washington. I really loved Grover. He was a great guy. I worked with Lil' Jimmy Scott. I worked with a lot of musicians in New York. You know, musicians say to me, why do you even want to do music, man? You can write. And writers say, man, why do you write, man? You can do music. Neither one of them sees how difficult the other one is. But see, I make my money as a writer these days. I make about 70% of my income, more like 80 now, as a writer. It used to be the other way around. If you see a turkey walking down the street and it's Thanksgiving, you don't walk to the vegetarian store and say, give me 3 pea sprouts and some string beans. You know, you grab that sucker around the neck, just, you know, choke him and get that grease from
him. I found out, my brother called me and he said that turkey hunting season was not around Thanksgiving, which I always thought it was in the fall. He told me in April, that's turkey hunting season. I never knew.
Well, Native Americans people tell you turkey hunting season is a whole nother time. They'll tell you, say, look, how about we invite you to dinner and kill all your relatives and we call it Thanksgiving? What do you think of that?
Is there going to be a movie? Are you working with Spike or somebody to make a movie of this book?
Of Song Yet Song?
Yes.
We talked about it quite a bit. We talked about it today. I talked to Spike almost every day because of Miracle of St. Anna.
Okay.
We started talking about this. We talked about this today a little bit as a movie.
Talk some more. This should be a movie. Anything else that you want to say about your book, your final statement on your book?
No, I just want to say thank you very much, and I hope that people are not disappointed when they buy it. I don't think they will be.
They won't. They won't.
It's the best book I've written so far.
Oh, goodness.
And
that's saying a lot because your books are good. I have all 3 of them.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. How much I owe you for that? Well, believe me, when the movie comes out, Spike made a great movie. He really did. And he raised the money himself. Spike went to Italy to raise the money. People don't know, but he was supposed to do the James Brown story. And when he got to Hollywood, he saw how much money they were going to give him to do James Brown. And he got on a plane, he flew back to New York, and he called me up. We know we did this on spec, no money. I wrote the script for it without a dime. I just did it on his word.
So you're the screenwriter, too.
Yeah, I wrote the screenwriter for Miracle of St. Anne. I did it on Spike's word. And you know why I did it? When I first met him, I didn't want to do it on his word. I didn't trust him. But Spike gave me that movie about Katrina. And plus, I knew Spike from the neighborhood. Spike is known in New York. You know, we love Spike. And he can be trusted. And so I wrote it on spec. And by the way, he paid me after he got the deal. And he paid every cent that he said he was going to pay.
Thank you, because that's what I want to believe about Spike Lee. That's
I've
been believing. That's what
Spike
I want
Lee,
to believe.
Of all the people working in Hollywood, you can bet your bottom dollar, and I mean it, Spike Lee is the real thing.
That does.
I mean, Spike Lee is committed to black people in their stories. I mean, look at his body of work. 21 films, every one of them says a little bit something about us. You know, not one person. Check the discography and the videography of all of these people. Spike Lee, Denzel Washington, these guys are committed to telling our story. And they put their reputations on the line. Spike had to go to Italy to raise the money for a movie about the all-black 92nd Division soldiers who fought in Italy for America and came home and faced enormous amounts of discrimination.
Think about Malcolm X. In order to do the movie that he did and should have been done, he had to go outside the studio and appeal to primarily black, I don't know if you know, but I know a whole lot of black folks who were millionaires who came through, and the fact that that many people came through for him said to me, this man is right, he is respected, these people believed what he did, and then he did a masterwork.
Spike is a person who doesn't really talk much, but when he says something, he really means it. He doesn't really say a whole lot, but when he says something, he really means it. He's very demanding to work with. He demanded a great script. I rewrote the script several times to get it the way he wanted it. And he added a lot of stuff, too. He really was determined to make a movie that would honor the 92nd Division, which has never been discussed historically, ever. They have never, I mean, we talk about the boys on the band, the boys in the bus, and E Company, F Company, G, H, I, J Company. Never talk about the B Company, African American Company. What about that? He did a great job. It's a wonderful movie. It's in 3 languages, Italian, German, and English.
Who's in it?
Derek Luke, Antoine Fisher, Michael Ealy, who was in Barbershop, Omar Benson Miller, and a guy named Lazio. I forgot his last name. And then, oh, John Turturro's in it. And yeah, a bunch of really good Italian and German actors. Mm-hmm. Filmed in Italy. He was there for 5 months.
Did you go over?
Buongiorno, come va bene. I went over there. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I went over there. I was over there for quite a bit.
You know something? I think that we're getting near the end of our a lot of time, so that means that you just have to come back again.
Okay.
Well, yes.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate you.
Thank you for
coming
being here.
I know y'all don't feel well, but thank you very much.
This is the close of the March edition of Black Book Talk. This is Patricia Welch saying good reading to you.
And this is Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman, saying we will see you in April.
Thank you very much.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 5 de noviembre de